That's no moon.
Hello there, and welcome to That's No Moon, a Star Wars Legion podcast. I am Cockles, and we have a group of people here today, and we have a bit of a one-off because we know you had the podcast last week, and you know you're going to have your next one next week, and then the crazy Christmas special, but we've got a special, and it's been lined up for a while. First off, here's the man, the myth, the met, the man who likes his hounds, Mr. Terrell. How are you doing?
Yeah, good man. How are you?
Not bad, thank you, buddy. Not bad. Recovering from the lurky, so I'm happy about life in there.
Not recovering from the loss of your team losing at the moment.
Well, it's the moment. They've still got another half to play. Still got a game and still a half. Shut your face. moving on. And then next up, he's not been on for a little while, but you definitely know who he is. It's Mr. Dyer. Hello there, how are you?
I'm good, mate. It's good to be back.
You're good, good, good. You've decided that being hit by big men playing rugby is painful for your health, and that means you can come back on the podcast for a little while.
Well, I mean, I've broken a rib, so it seems like the right time to return.
Oh, well, you would play egg-shaped sports, but that's what happens. Well, there we go. But we're joined with two special guests. Well, there's no other way to introduce them other than the last time we had someone from a developers on. Here's their intro. It's Will Schick and Andrew Dersom from Atomic Mass Games. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Guys.
Oh, thank you so much. I gotta be honest, I'm a little upset that this is not the Christmas extravaganza special.
Oh, hey.
you're welcome to come back for that one.
You're welcome to join, but it is crazy. And
it's just full of Cockles making up things.
It's not my fault.
I like it.
That's... honestly, if you do me out of a point on that Jaeger question again this year, I'm gonna come to your house.
That's fine. Maybe there won't be a Jaeger question, so I've got myself out of that one, so good. But guys, no, thank you for joining. Yeah, if you are welcome to join for the Christmas show, but it is crazy. There's not much Legion talk, but more there's like a Legion round with stats, and then was like packed in there. So in the tournament scene, which unit card was most taken, uh-huh. blah, blah, and all this sorts of stuff, yeah. Win percentages, loss, all that sort of stuff. And then after that, it's just pure craziness.
And it's like, what favorite film is Cockles?
Yeah,
like,
why not?
What is his favorite Star Wars film? Yeah. And it'll change weekly. Like, so you can't like
it's not changed. It's always Empire Strikes Back. Done.
That sounds like one that would be more fun to experience after the fact than to be a part of. To be honest, I feel like there'd be a lot of no comments coming from us.
It's always good fun to prep, and it's good fun to experience. And then even if I have to like be, I'm like the shepherd who has to control all the sheep to like do what I need to do. That's how it works.
It sounds like you're like Legion wrapped for the year, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. We've just Spotify wrapped did their thing, and we do our that's like TNM wrapped done in that random thing, and we get our guys like supporters come on to like the guys from like all the Patreon supporters and all this sorts of stuff. Which, by the way, we've got a special shout out to these guys. Thank you to those of you who are Patreon supporters. You will find that the majority of these questions are from you. So we basically put an appeal out weeks ago about questions for you guys, knowing you guys were coming on. And so the questions have come on. The questions we have are primarily from then. But just in case people have stumbled on our show for the first time ever, let's give a little bit of context as to who is who. Will, why don't you just tell us a bit about who you are, in case people don't know.
Oh, for sure.
And see what goes on.
Yeah, so I'm the VP of Creative Development and Strategy for Atomic Mass Games. What that basically means is that I oversee all of the creative production for the game. So I work with sculpting, I work with graphic design, I work with art, I work with engineering, I do product development and long-term planning strategy. So like, what are we going to make when? When are we going to release this character or that character? So if somebody's not in the game yet that you really wanted to see, you can blame me. It's totally and 100% my fault. And then I also get to work super closely with development on the design and rules development for the games themselves. So I am in the weeds with Andrew Dersom, who's lead on Legion, our development director, Will Pagani, and the rest of the team on all the other games. So I get to have my fingers in like all the pies when it comes to making these wonderful games that we get to do as a job.
Nice, nice. Thank you for that. And you segued into it there, but Andrew, do you prefer Andrew or Andy? Because we've already got another Andrew.
Andrew's fine. Although I don't really mind either one, so Andrew's fine.
Terrell, you're now Terrell for the rest of this show, okay? Just fine. So Andy, you know, tell us a bit about yourself and what you do and all that context, please.
Yeah, so I am a game developer with Atomic Mass Games. I've been with the company for a little over 4 years now. Before that, mm-hmm. I was a playtester on various projects that they had. And while we all work on everything and on the development team, I am the lead developer on Star Wars Legion. So that takes the lion's share of my time. And that's everything from, you know, turning the design concepts that we get into, you know, actual units and options in the game, running play tests, you know, conducting internal play tests, the balance updates that you see, you know, keeping an eye on kind of the barometer of how the game is doing in the wild and, you know, whatever my dev overlords Pagani and Schick require of me. So
yeah, it's a lot of fun. Praise the overlords, that sort of thing. Well, we have all the questions. We've got questions prepped, so I'll we'll start kick off because we're pressed for times and stuff. So let's get the show on the road. So first off, can start with Johnny Lighthead in Scotland asks, can you confirm Savage Opress will be available to the Shadow Collective? He's seen some discourse online, he just wondered. And so are you able to shed any more light on Savage?
Yeah, so we can confirm, yes, he's available in Shadow Collective. There's actually two different unit cards in that expansion. They are mostly the same. One allows him, his CIS version allows him to, or Separatist version allows him to synergize better with Count Dooku. To kind of be reminiscent of the time that he spends under his tutelage. And then the Shadow Collective version allows him to synergize more with Maul to kind of reflect the time that he's in the Shadow Collective with his older brother. So
nice, because obviously, go Andy, go on.
No, I was just excited. Like, both, all them characters are my, like some of my favorites. And I was just like saying Savage, like as well. Like,
it's a very Star Wars name.
I didn't realize until the other day he was voiced by the same dude who was what's his name, Zim from Starship Troopers, the drill sergeant,
Mr. Krabs. It's all the same guy. Yep.
I didn't know about the Mr. Krabs connection. That's crazy.
I saw something and it was Mr. Whitworth doing some more voicey stuff, and then it cut to, I was like, hold on a second, what's he doing there? And it was, what's his name, is it Clancy Brown or something like that?
Clancy Brown, yeah, you nailed it. Yep,
thank you. So yeah, he was, and I was just like, wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah, so that's that. Cool. Savage, anyone impressed? I'm looking forward to Savage as well. So that's all
excited.
Good. We have a question from Australia. Mr. Haslam says, how have you felt the first year of, quote, not 2.0 has been? What do you think was particularly successful, and is the current state of what you envisioned where it is right now, is it where it should be? He also says, is there anything you do differently a second time, anything that wasn't as successful as hoped? Quite a lot to pack in that question. So I suppose the first part of it is, now it's not 2.0 and now Europe mm-hmm. is now fully moved on. How are you feeling about how everything's gone down, or where everything sort of like the dust has settled on that one? I think that's the first part of the question.
I mean, I'll speak first. I think overall we're pretty satisfied with where we landed. I mean, we changed a lot of stuff. We mm-hmm. kept core foundations of the game, so it's, I think it's still very recognizable to Legacy or First Edition Legion, but obviously it's a much different game, right? The questions being asked, the way in which players are approaching the game, the way in which we are developing for the game and designing for the future has all been kind of realigned in ways that we believed would be beneficial and be positive for the game's long-term health and growth. And I think in the majority of cases, we were very close to the mark or hit the mark. And now we're kind of in that period of learning, okay, this didn't quite work out the way we thought, so we can make little adjustments here or there. And you're seeing the results of that through, you know, the points adjustments, through different updates mm-hmm. and some of the new upgrade designs and things like that. New missions will obviously have an impact. So overall, I think we're good. Maybe Dursum has a different take on that. Maybe he'll surprise me. Like,
no, yeah, I mean, I think as Schick said, it was just such a massive undertaking. You know, we had done a couple years ago, we did the rule book, right? Taking like the RRG to a rule book, which was kind of like the first foundation. And then this, you know, most recent big change up kind of like built on that foundation of the rule book we already had. And you're working on so much stuff and changing so much, and you're only able to do, you know, so much at a given time, right? You know, there's just some stuff that, you know, it's like, oh, we wish we could have gotten to that, but like, you know, we'll have to save that for later. I mean, overall, I have to agree with Schick. I think, you know, it's going really well, you know, and, you know, there's how the community reacts to, you know, what we did kind of, you know, we can, you know, like I said, keep our eyes on that and the, you know, what's going on in the community. And that helps, you know, give us information. I'm like, all right, well, you know, we've got a new, you know, mission pack coming up. Like, you know, how do we want to see how people are playing the game with the missions that we made? Did that go according to plan? Did not go according to plan? Like, what changes can we make for, you know, subsequent set of missions or units or battle forces or what have you? So.
You said, Will, there, like there was a few things that maybe you missed or like fell short of the mark. Is there anything that kind of stands out of what that was?
I mean, I think a lot of it wasn't super catastrophic, and we've been in the process of adjusting it. So obviously, you know, where the character points landed, probably not as aggressive as it should have been. And now we've really changed tack after seeing the initial results of, you know, the first round back in July of 2.6 before we fully moved into the edition, but some of that legacy was still there. And so we've adjusted character points pretty aggressively, the conservative nature on big units and their impact in the game and where those point costs should land. Obviously, you know, when players first got their hands on those following the mini Stravaganza announcement and update, we didn't see those as gravitated towards as much as we wanted. And what we learned was is that the valuation and the efficiencies that they brought from our internal playtesting and looks and just our hesitancy to make them too good was, you know, we just didn't push them far enough. And that's mostly been solved through points. And I think players have also adapted and adjusted to the benefits that those squads can bring. So it's a little bit of, you know, you have to give things time to plant and take root. And then also you kind of make adjustments along the way. I think those are the two big ones that I can think of.
I mean, you know, prepared positions, right?
Yeah, prepared positions was another one for sure. Yeah, for sure. How prepared positions kind of was evaluated and impacted. A lot of it, you know, a lot of it just comes down to you. Points are always a subjective guess, right? Like, I think we could spend a week arguing over the point valuations for various things and still maybe never come to a consensus, because you get to a certain point and it's like, what is the difference between 1 versus 3 points? And depending on your outlooks and what you're trying to accomplish with it and the army construction you have, like, you know, 3 points might be meaningless, but 3 points over 6 units might be the change between having a top tier tournament list and a bottom tier like casual list. Mm-hmm. The debates can get that fiery at times, whether that's real or not, right? And so I mean, I think like overall, right, it's just mostly been where we landed in terms of what we felt was within the curve, and now it's really refining the curve to be an exciting and enjoyable experience all around, and to see the things and the play patterns that we were hoping to see at when we made these changes become more live and more effective for players who want to, you know, maximize or use them.
Yeah, and it's in an iterative curve as well, isn't it? So you might increase points as things overtuned and then tweak it back down again as time progresses and brings units back in and out of favor as well, right? So
I think the only thing, you know, if we want to get salacious, the only thing where the jury is probably still out on is turn zero. And is that hitting the level of turn zero is important but not overly important to the outcome of the game? Again, that can be kind of subjective. It can be hard to really pin down. There's a lot of variables that go into it. But as we've seen, you know, with Marvel Crisis Protocol, we've changed turn zero 3 times now. We just did the latest change, which was a pretty big overhaul. The first time we changed it was minor. It was like some numbers, but it changed the predictability of what players would be able to pull out of that. You know, we changed in Legacy First Edition Legion, we changed turn zero there too, because we saw how it wasn't really hitting what we felt was what turn zero should be doing. It had an outsized impact on the overall experience and play patterns of the game. Did we get it right this time? I doubt it. You know, how far off the mark are we? I don't know. I know that there are a lot of folks and there's a lot of discussion in the community because we listen to it all that says, you know, we're way off the mark. We're pretty close. Things are fine. Like, I think, you know, it's going to be a couple of years before we really can sit back and say, okay, here are all these missions, you know, because right now we're working with a very limited set. We don't even have 10 missions yet. We're going to get there, right, in short order in March-ish of next year. The new mission pack will release and all of that stuff. And then we'll have, you know, we'll have more than six. We'll have, I think, a healthy set. And then following that, there's going to be another mission pack and another mission pack. So is it diversity that's missing? Is it the foundational structures that's missing? I mean, I don't think we know. So that would be the one where it's like, you know, did it come out perfect? No. Did we expect it to come out perfect? Maybe Dursum did, but I didn't.
As you said, it's a very iterative process, right? And you know, we can do all the math in the world and all the internal external play testing, and we do an incredible amount of all of that. But at the end of the day, right, like the first, you know, week or month that the thing's released in the wild, the public will play more games than we ever did internally or externally play tested. And so there's just some stuff like, you know, as Ishik said, you know, like the points we can take the most educated guess possible, but sometimes we're still off a little bit. And so it's a very iterative process of, you know, trying to make, you know, reconcile making that best educated guess possible on what is the correct thing, and then seeing how that lands and just adjusting and be like, all right, how do we dial this in further and get towards, you know, as close to correct as we can be, knowing that correct may change over time, right? Just on kind of how the game is going.
Yeah, you mean you could drive yourself insane as developers if you try to quantify every keyword as a points value, every dice, and is a red dice worth this in melee, or is it worth this in ranged? Sure. What does it do with it? How much is pit? You drive yourself insane because it's not really so much of the keywords, it's what the unit's on, and then what that unit is doing, if that makes sense. So, yeah, I'm with you.
I was going to say, and then variables that we can't even predict. There's no math. Right. Like, what does your table look like? Where's that terrain placed? What
positioning?
What is your opponent bringing? Exactly. Right? How is your dice luck for that day? Like there's and that's why, you know, we always say these games are never going to be perfectly balanced. It's impossible. Yep. These games are imperfect systems, and our goal is to simply design within a curve that makes player skill a priority factor in determining outcomes, along with the randomness, along with everything else, and then to make sure that through player skill every choice is a viable option. And the amount of percentage of impact it may have on a player's ability to win can be offset by player skill differentials, right? And if we can do all that and make the things really thematic and make it feel like you're playing a Star Wars narrative on the tabletop, you know, we've done, I think, the best job we possibly can do and the job that we set out to do every day.
Cool. Ollie, I think you've got the next question.
So this one is from Basmataz in the UK. He's asking, there was a talk of Escalation League kits and new store tournament kits. Do we have a rough timeline for when those are coming?
I believe those are already out. So the Escalation rules packet should be available on the website under the league rules. And that includes kind of like how you can utilize the standard tournament and league kit, which release quarterly effectively, to run an escalation. But there's not like a dedicated escalation league kit, I guess. So stores have the option of running an escalation league with the tournament and league kits, which rotate out, I think, every 4 months, approximately. Then you can also utilize, assuming that your Asmodee distribution center is part of the retailer support program, which we offer for free through Asmodee, but it's regionally dependent because DUs have to opt in, and I don't know exactly where you are based on who's listening and all that stuff. So the best thing you can do is talk to your store and have them talk to their distribution rep and say, hey, do you guys offer the retail support program that AMG does? Those are free promotional kits. So folks would likely have seen the last one was based all around the starters, and it had special edition cards for the command cards that came in the faction specific cards that came in the starters. So those are available as well. You can take those components and stores can do whatever they want with them. They can use them as pre-order incentives. They can use them to run events, which an escalation league could be run with one of those kits. So there's a bunch of different ways to do it, but the rules and stuff all should be available on the organized play section of the website. And the idea was to try to make it in such a way that there's multiple ways for stores to be able to support that through some of the offerings that we make. And if your store hasn't seen those or is having trouble getting those, the best thing to do is have them talk to their rep and ask about them, because they've been going through the process now for the last year, I believe. So
cool. And then the follow-up, I suppose.
You got a follow-up, is that Cuckles?
Yeah, go for the follow-up on the next one, mate.
Oh, right. Sorry. I thought you said you had a follow-up.
No.
So what we just said.
The follow-up.
So this is from Zach and a number of others. I believe Zach's over in the US. Can we assume there are plans for other battle forces, perhaps a full Geonosian force?
Yeah, I mean, there's always plans for more battle forces. So I think they're one of like my favorite things personally to design. I mean, Shit can attest to this. Either myself or he or Pagani or someone on our team will always just like randomly come up with an idea of like, man, this would be like really cool as a battle force, and sometimes they happen and sometimes, you know, they don't. But it's just really fun to, you know, kind of take, you know, something that's already existing and kind of spin a new way to play it, you know, kind of with like the new you know, Stormtrooper battalion, or kind of just go completely off the wall, you know, with like Tempest Force or Imperial Remnant or some of the more wackier ones or Shadow Collective. So yeah, there's always plans for more battle forces in the future. You can definitely expect to see a lot more of those of varying complexities.
Don't want to give a little spoil reveal. No, exclusive.
Oh, that's up to Shit.
Oh, that's up to me. I'm the one who always gets blamed for everything.
That is called passing. That is called passing the buck.
Exactly, and the buck's got to stop somewhere. So, since Geos was specifically pointed out, yes, there are plans in the works to make a Geonosian battle force. However, I think that being able to create a battle force that feels robust and interesting and all of that is dependent on a couple of releases that we haven't seen yet. So I think the theme just isn't quite fleshed out to the point of where we would need it to be to make that battle force feel not like Droid Invasion, but with some bug people.
Yep.
And that's a big thing with battle forces, right? Like Dersim said, we want these to feel like very unique offshoots or sub factions almost, right? Like you're playing Empire, but you're not. Remnant doesn't feel like any other Empire that you can play. Stormtrooper Battalion may feel similar ish, but it has enough, I think, unique components that it's like, it's rewarding you for playing very in theme and taking just a ton of Stormtroopers like we see in the media. The Wookiee Battle Force is kind of the same. It's very unique in that it's just like mostly all Wookiees. Yep. If you want to play it that way, and it allows people to do that. And I think those are like, you know, we, like Dersim said, we have conversations all the time where people gravitate towards a unit that they just really like, or a concept that seems really cool. Our creative director, Dallas Kemp's one that he brings up at every meeting is the Dewback Force. Dewback 1, where it's just like he just wants to be able to run an entire army of nothing but Dewbacks.
Please no, please no, no, no. Although Dave Grant would probably love that, but no.
Amazing.
You know, like is that enough to make a battle force out of? No, right? Like, I mean, you could, but is that something that's healthy for the game? Is it something that's intriguing and interesting? Probably not, just by a general concept, but I think those are kind of the foundational ideas that start battle forces. Or we look at the media and we say, hey, you know, we're making Ewoks, we're obviously going to do this Bright Tree Village idea, we really want players to be able to play the story of Endor, let's make a battle force that really replicates the Imperial forces that the Ewoks fought against. So if you want to play kind of a quote-unquote historical matchup with your gaming club buddies, you can do that, right? And that also gives us the opportunity to like flex our minds and play with player collections in unique ways and open up exploration and stuff like that. And then the other key to it, as Dursun mentioned, Shadow Collective, is that it is a really critical tool in order to be able to explore more of the niche like zones of the Star Wars galaxy. Things like Shadow Collective, which isn't a standing army, it doesn't make sense as a fully fleshed out faction, because like when you say this thing is a faction, what you're committing to is that for the life of the game, for the next 30, 40, 60 years, whatever, that faction is going to see regular releases. There's going to be some kind of influx of new things that are going to continually build that faction up. And that can be a daunting task. It can be an impossible task in certain situations. So then the question becomes, okay, well, how do we explore things like Dathomirians? How do we explore things like Shadow Collective? How do we explore things like Hutt Cartel? How do we explore things like, you know, whatever, take your pick of something that we've seen in the media that makes sense on a Legion battlefield, but in the general aggregate of how the game is constructed to be canonical, but also player choice, you know, Ewoks are a great example of this. Yes, they fight with the Rebellion, but they never shift Ewoks off as part of the regular Rebellion army, right? So you as a player can choose to do that in your player choice games as you create your own Star Wars narrative. But we as stewards of the Star Wars IP and the story, and as good partners with LFL, have to ensure that player choice is not the only way in which the game is expressed, and that the game can be expressed in a more true to narrative, true to canon situation.
Yeah.
And battle forces give us the ability to do that, because we could say, okay, here's how you play the Ewok army, and it is based around this theme, and here's how it ties into the narrative, and here's how it all locks in. And then with the mercenary rules, we can say, now do whatever you want with these mercenaries, right? And so it's a fine balance, but it is one of those things where like the battle forces are an incredible tool, both from creativity and from the ability to do exploration within the big galaxy that is Star Wars.
That makes
sense. There totally will be more.
Nice.
They're very great at capturing, like Schick said, like if you almost want to do like a historical refight, right? Like they're very good at capturing specific snapshots in time and of the media, right? Where it's things like Ewoks that don't really appear somewhere else, right? Like it lets us, you know, capture those specific scenes and translate it to the tabletop in a way that, you know, would be more difficult if it was an entire faction.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes absolute sense.
Blizzard versus Echo Base is a... It's delightful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. I think that is like the epitome of the Legion experience in many cases. When you try to describe Legion to someone, the first, and I'm an OT trilogy guy, right? Like, the original trilogy was my Star Wars, so of course it's top of the line. But like, whenever I'm like, what do you do for a living? Oh, I make Star Wars games. Oh, what kind of games? Like Monopoly? No, they're like battle games. Like think Episode 4 when the Rebels are fighting on Hoth against the Empire, right, with the big walkers. Like, we make games that tell that story, right? That replicate that experience. And they're like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, like everyone can kind of see that. So yeah, it's, I think that one is very iconic from a, what is Legion? It is that, right? Or at least that's, I think, what it wants to be.
I agree. Yeah, I completely agree.
I mean, whenever I run demos, I always say put the biggest things on the table to grab attention, and like ATSTs and like any form of tanks, the more the better for demos, personally. So for, I think this might be more aimed at Dursun because it's about bounty hunters. They seem to have disappeared from 2.6 from Chris Goodwin in the UK. Apart from a fleeting glimpse of Din, he says. Will they get a refresh, and might we also see a rework of Secret Mission, as well as it's harder to score, especially when the units with them are particularly squishy? But I guess that was, that question was posed before Cassian was released.
Yeah, I think.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, he definitely had that before Cassian was released. Yes, is the short answer on that one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said earlier, one of the things that we do is, you know, we're kind of constantly keeping our finger on the pulse of the game, and, you know, what's going on, what is working, what is not working out. You know, and then we have to reconcile, like, all right, these are all the things that, you know, we have to do, you know, in terms of maintaining the current state of the game, making new things. And we only, you know, have so much time, right? So we have to prioritize certain things. And, you know, for one of our, you know, biannual dev updates. So the bounty hunters are definitely something that we're looking at right now. And I, you know, would expect to see some sort of something with them in the future.
Excellent. Big fan of them as well. So I look forward to that. Then we've got a question from Dave Grant, and his is more business orientated. It says, what is the corporate structure stroke crossover of AMG and Asmodee? What are AMG's aspirations in the term of scale in miniature games competitors? Is it massive in comparison? What do AMG and Asmodee need to do to get as large, if there is such aspirations?
Oh, you have... That's a great subject for a podcast that could last forever.
So it's a very Dave question.
Yeah. I like it. So the best way I've found to describe the Asmodee system and the AMG relationship, there's two, but I'm an old school guy. I already said, you know, I liked the original trilogy. That was my Star Wars. So I come from a day and time where, like, before digital music, when the hope of every, like, independent band ever that formed in a garage was to get signed by a record label, because once you got signed by a record label, you had made it, right? And that's how you got big. And that is really the Asmodee system. So the other corollary that works really well is if you just think of modern video game companies and how video game studios work with larger publishers like EA, right? And effectively what that means is that we are 100% part of Asmodee. We're not separate. We don't have, like, some kind of agreement or anything like that. We work for Asmodee. Our role in the studio system is to create the music or create the games. And then Asmodee's role in the overall ecosystem is to be the publisher and distributor of those products. So there's, you know, I know things are kind of presented in that the studios take the forefront with the communities that they generate. And that's really based on the idea that, you know, the industry is very much about having these personal relationships, these insights into the game studios that you really come about and enjoy, and through the lifestyle elements of these games. And that's all kind of very true. But the reality is like, we're not independent going through Asmodee. We are all part of the Asmodee family. And what that means is to the second part of the question, like, how big does things want to get, you know, how does that stuff grow? That is all stuff that is also handled by, you know, Asmodee in general. So they have they have their own executive team. They have all of these different elements that a global corporation does. And what we do is we provide insight into, like, here's where we want to go. Here's what we want to do. Here are our plans to expand these games or expand the studio. We work. And our head of studio, Simone Elliott, along with our, they call it the PLM, but basically he's our finance guy, our studio finance guy, Brandon Anderson. That is primarily their day-to-day, is that they are communicating with the corporate exec team and the finance teams and the business development strategy teams and, you know, the VP global head of publishing and all these different people who make up this big conglomerate, because Asmodee is, you know, it's game studios, it's distribution, it's manufacturing and publishing, it's all these things. So it is a huge, you know, it's a huge, serious, like, legit corporation. And those conversations, like, they're kind of generated by us. We provide the ideas and the way in which we think we can grow in advance. But the overall, like, where is Asmodee growing, which includes the studio, is very much a product of the groups and the people in charge. of the corporation as well. So like, were you to ask me, you know, do we want to be as big as Games Workshop? I would imagine that if you could go to any CEO or any kind of publicly traded company and said, do you want to make $300 million on miniatures a year? They would say, yes, please. You know, and then you would get down into the weeds of like, okay, well, how does that work? And the reality is not necessarily the desire to do that. It's the ability to do that. Because just as we only have so much time in the day to be able to do, you know, so much in development, so much with the games that we do and all of this, we have to be careful with our limited bandwidth and resources. Even the biggest corporation in the world also has to do that, right? Like, it's not just us, it's Fantasy Flight, it's, you know, Days of Wonder, it's every studio that falls under Asmodee, and then Asmodee's global distribution network, everything else, right? So, well, everyone would probably love to be GW. The reality is just that there are things that you have to be able to do, there are resources that you have to have, there are risks you have to take in order to hit that, and does that make sense for the overall whole? And I think, you know, again, as the studio, we don't really answer that question. We simply say, this is what we can provide. These are the things we can do. And it's a negotiation or a discussion. And just like any department within, you know, a corporate structure as to what resources can they provide? What can we provide back? And how do we work towards a shared goal, which is just the overall betterment of the entire group? So there's the really, like, everyone has tuned out now. They're like, I don't even care about this stuff. What are you talking about? And then we can jump back into the more exciting, like, let's talk about Legion again questions.
So I'll say, because I'm sure he'll be saying thank you. Dave says thank you. Because he would want to have known that one.
It's really interesting as well, though, like, because obviously we do just have that kind of see you as AMG. Mm-hmm. But then obviously it is Asmodee as well, like, as a front, but we never have that communication or line with them. So, like, understanding how that all works does help the community, because sometimes I do feel that maybe you receive bad flack. It's really hard to get hold of stock. Well,
mm-hmm. Wrongly aimed.
Yeah, and I think that's obviously not your decision. That's not your fault, and that's not necessarily Asmodee's fault either. But it's all like a group effort and a group decision, isn't it? Like, so sometimes mm-hmm. I do feel if people know how your relationship is and how things work, it helps distribute the flack in the right direction.
Yeah, it's kind of just like corporate business as usual mm-hmm. stuff, right? No, nobody, like you said, nobody's completely at fault. Everyone has things that we're always trying to improve. And obviously the goal of, I think, anybody in this industry is to make people happy all the time, but you're not going to do that. The other real interesting shift, right, has been that for a long time, the studio system and us being front and center and the Asmodee name not even really appearing on any of their studio's products, right? Like EA, it's an EA game, it's made by the studio. Asmodee for a long time, especially even when we started the studio, was very much like, we just kind of want to be, they really wanted to be the record label, or it's like a small bug or just non-existent. And the mm-hmm. band, you know, the name is the thing that you're selling, and you're marketing these unique groups, these studios, as their own thing. In the last year, really, they've pivoted. And now if you've been paying attention to like Asmodee messaging or to convention banners or things like that, you'll see that there's a very present Asmodee branding. And so they have kind of moved into this transition where, like, now Asmodee, they're moving more towards the EA system where, like, it's an Asmodee game and the studios have a unique input print or fingerprint, right? Like, if you're a Call of Duty player, you probably have very strong opinions on which Call of Duties were the best based on which studio made them.
Yeah.
I think where they're in their corporate marketing and their mindset as to how the Asmodee studio interaction is shifting, is to be more of that classic video game rather than the record label. Like, they're behind the scenes, they don't really mention themselves much, they let the band do the marketing. So the question where the question's born from, and that kind of the confusion as to like how the system works, may be a thing of the past in 3 years as this new process and this new kind of branding goes forward, which is interesting. But again, that's all like really dry business marketing stuff that it's fascinating to me as somebody who engages with it a lot and watches different trends and things, but it's not quite as exciting as like, why don't those stormtroopers roll red dice instead of white, Dursum?
Well,
I was enjoying the record label metaphor.
Of course. Yeah. I liked it. Yeah. That and the Call of Duty one did make me giggle a bit as well. Let me go on. We shall move on to a man who, for a question from a man who, if you notice a spike in sales in LATs, this will be because of him. Joe Austin says, are there any plans for large, the man owns too many, are there plans for large scale vehicles such as AATs or ATTEs? This is a Dersom question, I suppose.
Oh, gosh.
I like it. Don't mess up, Dersom.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think everyone in the studio would, like, personally, you know, love if something like that happened. I think that's more, if anything, like a logistical question, you know, right? Because, like, in a perfect world, right, like, we're playing this game with, like, on a hollow, you know, table, like, on the Millennium Falcon with, you know, stuff. So I think, you know, Schick can elaborate that on that. But I think that, you know, comes down to things other than do we just want to make it, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of considerations when you talk about big stuff, right? Like, obviously, we want Legion to have a fairly consistent scale. Those folks who have gotten out their calipers and really broken down the numbers will know what I'm about to say for a long time, but this might shock some people, which is that Legion is on a sliding scale when it comes to its vehicles. So every vehicle in Legion is approximately 12% smaller than it should be compared to the typical height of a character, like a normal man-sized figure within the overall scale of the game. And that was done before we even took stewardship of the game. So that was an FFG move, and that was to make vehicles more reasonable for the table size and to make them more manufacturable and stuff like that, right? That the question then becomes, when you talk about something like a Hellfire droid or an HMP droid or an ATTE or what have you, you know, as you start to get bigger and bigger, how much can you shrink the scale before it starts to look wrong and it loses kind of that presence or that feeling of grounded realism?
Yep.
The big one from a development standpoint is the bigger the thing gets, the bigger the base gets, and the bigger the base gets, the more movement becomes a problem.
Yeah.
To provide a little bit of a spoiler, we did do way back when we first took over the games, just for funsies, oh, yeah, and for interest, we created an ATTP?
Yeah, I think that's it.
It's the sniper. It's the tri-legged sniper one, which now there's too many ATs. You see it in the Battle of Kashyyyk.
It's the three-legged one.
I think I know which one you mean. The tripody, yeah. Plonky, big, yep, like nose cannon thing on it as well.
ATAP, that's what it is. Not
ATAP, that's right.
Silly. ATAP. And so we did one of those at scale, and it was awesome. But when we kind of looked at, okay, what does this mean for how do you get it on a base? How does the size of that base interact with how movement works? Does movement even work when your base is so large that it's twice the size of your deployment area? Like, these kinds of things. And those questions are absolutely solvable on a timeline, but I think, you know, you then go into, well, is this something that we want to see in Legion, in basic Legion? Is this something that is best saved for the new, you know, Grand Army, the full scale war that we're going to be working on and showing off in its alpha version at Adepticon for players to sign up for that event and be able to take in? Where do these things fit, right? And we did have a conversation once. I had one of the Kenner AT-ATs that my kid still has. He calls it his robot dog. He's 16, still has it in his room, loves it. It was a surprise gift from Santa that he's still very attached to. And, like, that thing is effectively scaled appropriately to Legion. And so when you look at how big that is versus what an AT-AT would be, you can kind of start being like, okay, well, how do you even begin to make this work? And yeah, there are ways to do it, you know, where you're like, it's a special scenario, it's this, it's that, all these things. But it'd be foolish to say we haven't thought about it and we're not still trying to work through those things and where they fit. Beyond just game specifics, though, then it becomes like, okay, well, how much is that thing going to cost? And are there enough players in the world who would be willing to outlay that kind of cost for these things. And that's really a question of community size, right? Because the answer is yes, there's always people who want that thing, right? There are always people who are willing to really dive in on the crazy, like, expensive, you know, we've seen Titans being sold that are the size of human beings and all of this stuff. Like, but you have to have a big enough slice of people, a big enough percentage of people to make sure that you can actually manufacture those things.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair.
And so I think part of it is just a timing question, you know, as we hopefully see the community grow and we get more and more, to go back to the previous question, more and more into that, like, we all want to be Games Workshop and be the kings of the castle and have, you know, a huge global community, like massive, massive global footprint.
Yep.
Then making an AT-AT, even if only, you know, 5% of the community globally is going to buy it, it might be worth it, right? It might be viable at that point. But, you know, if you come out of the gate swinging and you're just like, we're just going to make it now, and you sell three of them, well, I'm not going to have a job. So there are some harsh realities to making those decisions that you have to be, you know, aware of, right?
Yep. Well, I hope that sort of, that's quite interesting. You try baking that one. I quite like that. Moving on. So Baz Mataz says, you touched on Escalation League. So I'll go to the second part of his question, which was, has there been any consideration for wreckage, e.g. when a bus or a tank is destroyed, it's down the table as a burning wreck and be impassable to rain?
I recognize a second edition 40K player and I love them for it, because when tanks just exploded and came off the table, that was a blow to every miniatures gamer's heart ever. I mean, from my standpoint, it could absolutely happen. It obviously isn't a thing that exists in current Legion, so I don't know what Dursum's feelings on wreckage and that kind of stuff are. That would be a significant change, so I don't think we'd see it outside of an edition change, honestly, but you never know.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big flavor guy, and, you know, especially when people go all out with that stuff and they get the little, like, the wool, or, you know, even better when it's got, like, the little LED light inside. Yeah. That flickers, you know, that stuff is cool. But yeah, I mean, Schick is right. You know, that's such a substantial change that it would have to kind of feel like it'd have to be part of like a bigger overall overarching package of changes.
Yeah.
Instead of something that we just, you know, snuck into like an April or November update.
Not 3.0 then.
Ollie, what you got?
So we've got
a question from Zach in the US again. So he has asked, are there plans for a Spec Ops card pack?
Yes, there's plans for a lot of spectral operation stuff. unfortunately, there's no like determinant time, right? Okay. I think we very much like the, I think there's a lot of good things that Spec Ops does. From an entry level point, from a kind of appetizer experience when you don't have time for maybe a full Legion game, you know, when we're now talking about full scale war, which is the big version. And I think these games are healthiest when they have multiple expressions. And I was really, really satisfied with where Pagani was able to bring Special Operations out in terms of its connection to large Legion, you know, with the order stack being maintained, with command cards being maintained, but really drilled down into individual actions. So I think, you know, from like a where would we love to go perspective, putting those cards into print is obviously a one step. Making it into a supporting product line is another one that I think we would really love to explore as time allows, and to kind of make it something that stands alone but also supports the main game as much as we hope this full-scale war experience will. Again, it just all kind of comes down to timing and bandwidth. And so really that's the strength of the print and play stuff that we're able to do and the way in which we can expand the game for players who are very interested in that stuff via, you know, digital documents and printed home kind of expansions. It removes some of the product risk and the manufacturing risk, which lets us be a little more experimental. Because all of these decisions have to get vetted from a viability standpoint. And when you come and say, well, let's make a small version of the big game, people kind of look at you and they go, but won't you sell less? And you're like, yes, but we won't, because this isn't going to replace that game. It's going to do this, right? And so sometimes you kind of have to prove that. And the amazing thing about the digital age we live in is that we can take those swings with minimal risk. And if they get adopted by the community, it's kind of a proof. It's kind of Kickstarter without the Kickstarter, right? Yep. In some ways, where you can be like, hey, we have this market data now that says players want this. They're enjoying it. We can show that it's boosting engagement here, here, and here. So we have the business case study to prove the fact that what we're proposing is viable, healthy, and will be beneficial across the board. And then sometimes it just lets us hit, you know, the percentage of the community that we really want to, you know, the folks who just want to be able to play a skirmish unit based kind of like individual hero hammer-ish game with their Legion miniatures. And if that's 200 players, you know, the amount of time that we spend on that, we can be like, whatever, they liked it and it's cool. And everyone sees it and goes, oh, they're engaged with the game and they're making cool stuff. Sometimes, you know, I think about all of the expansion articles or stuff that came out of White Dwarf or things like when I was playing, you know, 20 years ago when I was playing Games Workshop games and stuff. And I don't think we played a quarter of that stuff, but every time we saw that something new was there that we could do with our miniatures, we talked about it for a week and we got really excited about it. And we were just like, oh, this is amazing. This is why we love engaging in this hobby, because look at all these things we could do. We won't, but we could do it. And sometimes you can do is just as important as the actual doing of the thing. And so again, that's kind of where it comes down to, like, having that print and play opportunity is really, really nice.
I would say everyone has aspirations of doing something with their miniatures that they just never have time to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's like we say with them when we talk about, you know, in particularly Marvel Crisis Protocol and Shatterpoint, right? Like every character is someone's favorite character, right? And so kind of extrapolating from that a bit, like, you know, all these different ways to creating additional ways to play or different ways to play is only going to be a good thing, because, you know, while this certain mode or variant may not be super popular in your community, your store, somewhere it's someone's favorite way to play, you know, like somewhere in the world, there's people that they just, every time they play Legion, they're playing Spec Ops, right? Instead of the normal game. So Ishik's right. Like, just adding these additional ways to play is just, it's only good things. It only just, you know, helps grow the community in different ways.
Yep, that makes sense. Ollie, what you got next?
So, unsurprisingly, this is from the Reverend Podfrey, so it involves statistics. Jeff is called Reverend Podfrey because he has a church of followers in Legion for the lists that he runs. He says 90% internet statistic of players play standing orders on round one to try and go last. This creates feels bad when you win the role for priority, as you have to put a unit out to literally get shot. Would you consider giving the choice of priority to the player with the lowest pip, which could encourage different command cards to be played?
Sure. So, yeah. So one of the things that I don't know if we 100% got right on, you know, going back to the earlier question, is, you know, your first round command card, right, is a lot of times you'll, if you have a specific card to kind of, especially something that gives you like free moves, or free tokens, right? Or that kind of co-aligns with your game plan that you're going to do. Like, for example, like Yoda lists, they'll play Luminous Beings round one sometimes, or you know, Darkness Descends with Vader. But a lot of times we see that players just choose Standing Orders to try to, you know, go last, right? And the power of having that, you know, not just delaying your activations as you deploy early in the round, but also to try to get the last activation of round one. And that's something that we've been, you know, keeping an eye on, you know, as opposed to like doing changes, you know, if, Shik, don't get mad at me, but to be like a little spoilery, you know, in the full scale war variant, that we're going to be play testing Adepticon, that actually is how it works, is, you know, whoever has, the lowest priority gets to actually choose whether to activate first or second. So will that make it to the base game? I don't know, but, it's definitely a thing that we have, you know, looked at.
Interesting.
And are looking at.
I like it. And Andy, I think you've got a follow-up from the Reverend on there as well next then. Because he goes in details. There's no halves on the Reverend.
It's a long one. So the short term, the too long didn't read, is, are sniper teams on your radar for review? For example, I think the reason for high cost is that they are Jedi killers. Switching off deflect and running the full free will put a dent in the Jedi's day. But if high velocity was immune deflect instead, the Jedi would still get the deflect save, not just bounce it back. This would enable a points drop on the weapon, also 20 base points for a naked 1 health surge white save model. Even with low profile, sharpshooter 1 is not worth 20 points. If they dropped to, say, 15 and with immune deflect instead of no deflect, the rifle went to, say, earlier than mid-30s, then I think you might see some play again, because someone wants to be a games developer by the sound of this question. But,
well, I think sniper teams have been one of the hot debates in general among the community for a little bit now. So it would be a lie to say we're not actively looking at that discussion and having our internal discussions and things like that. There's a lot of, you know, again, this is a subject that we could probably talk for an entire hour on. There are a lot of ripple effects to making strike teams cheaper. That aren't just their effectiveness or their efficiencies in the game. There's the fact that they give you more activations, right? And they allow for stronger order control because they have the same rank as their parent unit. So, you know, because they don't count against your allotment, you can kind of cheat the order stack that way and you can find more consistency. And perfect order control is a tension point that is foundational to the game. And it's something that we don't want players to be able to easily solve. And I think, you know, people have started to recognize that through some of the changes that we implemented in second edition. And likely they will see that going as a through line for many of the things going forward, is that we never want players to be able to make it perfect, right? Like, we always want there to be inefficiencies, because inefficiencies is where innovation comes from. And where I think the fun experience of playing these games happens. So there is the question of, like, how do you make strike teams and snipers better for the cost and that they feel good to take? And then there's also the question of, like, how do you do that in a manner that doesn't cause ripple effects that actually worsen other parts of the game with unintended consequences? And I don't know if you want to expand a little bit or more on that, Dursum, or if you have additional.
Yeah, I mean, those of us to deal with it directly. Yeah, no. I mean, you know, those of us that were there 3,000 years ago, right, at the start of Legion, we kind of remember, you know, the cultural trauma of, you know, when the sniper teams were running rampant. And it's just kind of this, you know, as Shika said, there's so many different facets to them at a unit of, you know, angles to approach or things to look at. You know, he talked about, you know, the rank and the order pool issues. You know, there's kind of the elephant or bantha in the room of, like, they're a very cheap relatively way to access Pierce 1, which is probably the most powerful offensive keyword in the entire game, right? So it's, you know, okay, well, we see that people aren't taking these, we want to make them better, but, you know, we also want to be cautious of, you know, we don't want to make them, you know, an auto include option, right? And just, you know, a lot of people have a bunch of Pierce 1 everywhere, and because that's not particularly super interactive or fun to be on the receiving end of. So it's just kind of a balancing act. And, you know, as Shik said, that we're looking at, and we want to get it right in a way that, you know, makes it feel good to take these units and play against them, and also, you know, captures the fantasy of what it is to, you know, have a you know, sniper team on the battlefield. So
And then Chris Goodwin from the UK says, would it be great to know the play testing process and how changes are determined? It's very obvious from player sentiment and results which units need adjustment, e.g. arcs at the beginning of 2.6 and aquas now, or just prior to this question when it was first submitted. But some of the changes seem bizarre in the latest update. For example, the AAT down 15 points. How was playtesting indicated this unit needed a reduction, whereas some others were glaringly ignored, bounty hunters?
Well, if it feels random, it's because we have a big bucket that's filled with all of these different bones. We shake those up and we throw them out the window, and we wait 5 days and we come back, and then we employ several crows. I think so. There's a lot of factors that go into it, and the key factor is time, right? There is life in general is usually opposite forces putting you into tension and having to choose where you're going to kind of lean. And with updates and balance and all this other stuff, it's okay, we can dive into these things. We can say we're just gonna fix everything, if that was even possible, which obviously we've kind of established at this point that even if we fixed everything, it probably wouldn't be fixed. It would just be maybe better, maybe some of it would be worse, all of that would shake out, but we're never going to hit a point to where everything's right and it's going to stay that way, right? It's an imperfect system. It's an imperfect game. It's literally how it functions. But we could say, okay, let's correct all the things that are current hot buttons. But the counterpoint to that is that that's time we're not spending on new releases, new units, adding characters like Mace Windu to the game, adding Admiral Trench, maybe someday adding Django. I'm sure it's going to get asked, but you know, if we continue to only focus on correcting things that are currently in the game, then the Gungan question will never be answered. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we just wouldn't have the time to do that. And the reality of the situation is that, you know, you have to pick and choose. You have to say what is dramatically going to, and again, this comes back to a holistic perspective, what is going to push the game forward? What is going to bring the most value at this point in time that we can affect with the time that we have? And, you know, that might be, let's look at some things that are fairly quick and easy because we're under a heavy load right now because we have a major new release that's coming and it's taking 80% of the bandwidth. So we only have 20%. So how do we maximize that 20%? We might be at a point to where like everything's going really smooth with the new developments and we find ourselves with more time. And so we're like, hey, we have 50%. And part of my job is looking at the product schedule and knowing that these are living games is to create space for us to be able to have more time to look at things retroactively or to look at things where we can have more time to balance. So there might be a larger patch here because schedule wise, we are making fewer new releases because the game is at a point where we feel like we don't need that many. And then other times there might not be a lot of adjustments because the reality is that we're spending an inordinate amount of time creating a new subfaction or creating a brand new thing, right? That we feel is going to really dramatically impact and move the game forward. And at that point, it's like, all right, we got to be very choosy. So what is critically important and what do we save for later? But the reality is there's no finish line, right? I don't believe there's one. Now there's the reality that like the studio gets closed down and then I guess, you know, we just do this on our off time on a forum somewhere, but we don't operate that way. We don't see that there's a finish line that we're going to cross. We believe that this game will go on well beyond our time at the studio. And our job is to make sure that we're progressively pushing the game forward in the most positive fashions we can with the available resources we have. So, you know, Bounty Hunters, right? I don't think anyone's arguing that Bounty Hunters don't need a look. And we've tried to be as forthright and transparent as possible by saying like the character adjustments are a progression and we can't do them all at once. And so we started with the update in June. We've now done some additional character updates in the last one. There's no doubt going to be character updates in the next one, but sometimes it's not just points that make something better. Right. And so points are pretty easy. You can just manipulate point values and test them. But if you say fundamentally Bounty Hunters don't work anymore because of the legacy from their design originally, and now we have to redesign them, we have to kind of rebuild them from the ground up. That's not accomplishable on certain timeframes. So maybe they're going to take longer. And then the evaluation becomes, okay, if we let this thing sit, that's not doing very well, does it damage the game overall? And sometimes the reality is that if you're not overtuned, but you're undertuned, like if you're at the bottom or off the bottom of the curve, you'll sit longer because you're not breaking anything, right? There's a priority system there as well, which is it's a negative experience that you can't take your favorite characters if you love Bounty Hunters because you cannot make up that differential we talked about at the start with player skill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you know, that is not as critical to the overall game health because it's more subjective than, say, this unit over here that is dramatically breaking the high power level of the game, right, has become an auto take, and the only way to defeat it is by taking it itself. And so now everything's becoming very like monotheic, right, monolithic, in terms of its expansion. That has to be fixed right away, because it is going to severely damage the game to the point that it might not be recoverable. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we've really run into those instances necessarily, but those are kind of like, you know, the high end, the high end power level things that break the high end of the curve are always going to get priority over lower level things.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's that, sometimes it's just like these getting bounty hunters right is going to be more complex than simply adjusting points. So we're going to wait. Sometimes it is adjusting points, but we just don't have the time that we need to put in to these characters to get the points right. Sometimes it's we thought they were going to get solved, and then through playtest, which happens, we realize that we're not there yet, and instead of pushing something out that's half baked, we'll just hold on to it, because again, there are all these different like check boxes. So you know, there's a reality that bounty hunters might have been targeted for this last update, where the AAT dropped in points, and Dersim can give the reasoning to that question as to why we felt that was the right move to make. And through testing, we were like, we're not there yet. So the options are put out a poor fix that probably is going to cause more problems, whether emotionally or game wise, right? Because you're gonna be like, oh, they fixed them, but they didn't really fix them. And now they're never going to fix them again, because they think they're fixed and they're just stupid, right? They're like, you know, it's that the emotional, you can't separate emotional psychology from anything you do as a developer or designer. In fact, it's one of the most important aspects that you have to learn to understand, right? It's not just what does the math say, it's what does the player's heart say. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times players' hearts don't align with the math. Right. The number of times that players in playtest or players in the community have come back and been like, we don't like this, this is trash. And from a math standpoint, you're like, that is excellent. And the fix you are suggesting is actually mathematically, empirically worse. We always laugh about that internally, because the truth is that the math isn't right. It's how players feel about it. You know, it's the emotions these games and these things give you, and the way rules make you feel, because at the end of the day, what we're trying to elicit is an emotional response, which is fun. Right. And fun doesn't care about math. Unless you're Willem Rutan, his fun comes from math.
Oh my God. Like,
that boy only has fun when the math is good. But most people are not like that, right? And again, this comes back to the subjective thing. So why not bounty hunters? There's a number of reasons that it could be. Mm-hmm. And obviously we're not allowed to really pull back the curtain enough and say this is the specific reason. But I think this is a great conversation to have about just in general. Every time we do an update, we know that we're going to miss things that players are going to be disappointed by. You know, we're never going to have an update that's going to make everybody happy 100%. It's just impossible for us to do. The goal is to ensure, and hopefully what people will be able to come to trust in the process as we continue to do this, is that every update is going to be our best attempt to move the game forward in a positive direction, and that we are constantly engaged 100% of the time on continuing that process. So if we didn't get there today, we may get there tomorrow. And if we don't get there tomorrow, we will get there eventually, right? We're not in the business. We're not of the mentality of saying, meh, whatever, like we don't care. We take every miss very personally internally. Because again, every miss that we have is something that keeps us away from our goal, which is that every player that comes to play our games has fun.
I guess this goes back to the question about like quantifying keywords and points and things that you can forever be, you go insane about that. But also where the nerf stick taketh away from someone else and then the help stick giveth to someone else. It's kind of like, the opponent players, i.e. will take the AAT. Some people are going, I don't want to play AATs, I've had enough of them. Whereas the AAT player is going, hell yes, thank you very much. So it's there's no 100% consensus. I completely agree. It's like you're never going to get a full landing.
Yeah,
it's always just about the curve, right? Every question usually to why would we do something is because our analysis of where that curve is and what's healthy when, you know, this to this, for folks that can see me, some games have a curve like this, we want a curve like this.
Yep.
Right? So how do we keep that curve there, and how do we keep things on that curve? And ideally, we want everything to be on the top end of the curve, but that's not how curves work. So the more you push this way, the more the curve just kind of like shifts this way. It doesn't, you don't want it to get wider. Yeah. It's like all this stupid calculus that I opted out of.
I got to trig and I was like, enough.
Enough. Talk about the AAT, Dersom. Why wasn't it 17.5?
The AAT, I think, you know, as we're talking about, you know, we talk earlier, I think the AAT is very similar to kind of what you saw with some of the characters, right? Where it's not necessarily 100% about the AAT specifically, right? Like we've seen some other vehicle options come down as well. So part of it is like, yes, the AAT specifically, but also it's like looking at the larger meta, right? Like how are vehicles doing, right? Are they struggling? Are they doing well, right? Like, do we want to see more of them, right? Is this a unit that we want to see more of? Like we've said that we want to see more characters on the battlefield, right? So we're going to lower their costs. Are some of them too aggressive? Maybe. But does it accomplish, you know, the goal of kind of, you know, steering things a little bit towards, you know, the more what we perceive to be the correct direction or desired direction, right? So I think the AAT is a great example of that, like the LAAT too, right? The LAD, it's, you know, is part of that because we think the unit is maybe underperforming a little bit. Sure. Is part of it that we want to see more of these types of units on the battlefield? Yeah, I think that's definitely the case here. And to kind of build on what Schick was talking about earlier with like our timelines and playtesting, we do a lot of math. We do a lot of internal playtesting, right? I personally play multiple games of Legion a week, and it's been the case for years now. And that is a lot of time playing the game when you think about it in the context of all the other things that we have to do. And it's just, you know, like a bandwidth issue of like, you know, we're working on this thing. And then sometimes, as Schick said, we'll be testing something and, you know, we'll think, oh, well, this perceived direction isn't working, but maybe this direction will be better, but it'll take more time. And then that means that, well, maybe we have to move it to a different time and the timeline. And I really like that we have changed to this this kind of like biannual dev update schedule of November and April, because not only does it help us with that planning, right? Of like, okay, well, can we do this here? Or no, well, we can get the next one, right? It also helps a lot for the community because, you know, in the community, you're like, oh, well, like, when can we maybe accept a change, right? And that really signposts it to, you know, maybe you won't see all the changes that you were expecting or desired, but you know that, you know, we're looking at things, right? Just because something didn't happen and an update or a points change didn't go your way, it doesn't mean that we're not looking at it, right? It's not that we're not looking at sniper teams or bounty hunters. You know, like I spend a lot of time, you know, looking at tournament stats and tournament results. I am lurking in your Discords, right? We all are, right? we're paying attention to a lot of to all of this stuff going on. And you know, as Schick said, it's just a timeline and a bandwidth issue for what things happen when.
And then, I mean,
go ahead. No, I was just going to say, as a man who got to chuck out three saber tanks a couple of weekends ago, it was like, yes, please, more of this. Thank you very much. Love it. Sure. So fun.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing to keep in mind, right, is that the production timelines, even for points updates, still exist. So and we kind of talked about this when there was a lot of disappointment with the April update at the start of the year, right? People were expecting, I think, the moon. Some people were expecting just to see changes, and we were trying to be very to set expectations. We failed completely. And, you know, we've learned from that experience that don't expect much. There's not going to be that much new. And that came back to the conversation of like, even if Adepticon happens and we're like, this specific unit or this battle force or whatever is totally over the curve and blowing everything out, we can't in good conscience create changes within a week or 2 weeks, right? From a development standpoint, you're just basically throwing darts. You're going back to my joke at the beginning, which is like, just throw bones in a pot, throw them on the floor and read them and say, oh, well, this is clearly the answer, because you don't have enough time to analyze the data, to really understand the problem, to understand what the knock-on effects are. And that's the big one, right? A lot of the times when you kind of look at something, you say, oh, I understand what the problem is, just fix that. And it's like, okay, but it's not just understanding the problem in front of you. It's what does fixing that problem cause?
The ripple effect.
And And yeah, what's the ripple effect? And the challenge is beyond just what's the ripple effect to everything that the players or you all, it's community, know about. It's what's the ripple effect of the things we're doing that you haven't even seen yet. Because there's, we turn things over to manufacturing approximately a year from when they hit shelves. So any change we make within that year, we can't change that thing. So if we fix a problem, but it breaks something that's at print, that's not a really great solution because we're just going to eat it in X number of months. So we have to take into account, okay, what does this change do to things we can't change? And then the things that we're working on to deliver to production at the time also might have ripple effects. So how does that change things? Do we have enough time to adjust? Right. And this is the complex dance of what we do and why changes can feel like they take forever, is because our goal is not to have snow globe development where we're just constantly shaking things up and we never let the meta settle or the game system settle because players can never really see a stable environment. Our desire, our hope is that we create a stable environment from the get-go, which then empowers you as the players and the community to bring your innovation, your creativity, your skills to the table by combining things in unique and fun ways, rather than just never being able to sit there and be like, okay, well, I have no idea if this point value on this unit is going to actually apply by Saturday when I play my game, but I think this is the best thing now. And then on Saturday, it's like, oh no, it's not, because they changed everything again. And so, right, like rapid iteration and development is a way to keep players off balance, but it's not actually balance. It's just off balance. Mm-hmm. And that's not our goal. So, you know, we need time to test, and that testing window can be anywhere from, you know, 30 days if we're really rapid at it and we really dive into it, to, you know, ideally around 4 months is about 2 play test cycles, which the question to ask, like, what's the testing cycle like? So regardless of what you are, our goal is minimum 2 play test cycles, which equates to about 12 weeks. That doesn't include our internal alpha testing time, which is approximately another 6 weeks, right? Where we want to have about 6 weeks on that. So now you're talking about, you know, what are we at? 18 weeks. And then assuming that at the end of that cycle, we're not like, let's give it another cycle because we're not really sure about it, and we have the time to do it. Now, some new releases you do, some you don't. We try to plan out padding time just in case we hit that point. Now it's got to go through proofing, editing, layout, graphic design, like all this stuff. Then we have to peer review it internally and do all of these things to get it in its finalized form. That's at minimum another month, but typically we like to allow 6 to 8 weeks. And then once it's all done, it's got to go to our partners at LFL for them to review and approve and ask questions on. And that is another 6 to 8 weeks. So, you know, this kind of went back to the April thing of like people were really upset that we didn't make these rapid changes. And what we tried to explain and have continued to try to just illuminate through transparency on the process is, even if we had decided the day of Worlds at Adepticon to make X number of changes because, you know, these things were clearly untenable, it still would have gone past the date that we had already announced for that April update, because LFL, our partners, contractually, and even beyond contractually, just from being good partners, should get the time that they are owed to be able to review these things and make sure that, you know, we're representing the game and their properties properly. So, you know, we did our update on tax day for the US, which was April 15th. That was approximately two weeks after Worlds. If we had gotten things done in a week, even then, those changes wouldn't have been out until, you know, first week in May, maybe, you know, if everything went well. So there's just a reality of how long things take to do, even if you're not trying to do full due diligence, because of the way in which those systems go. And I mean, I'm not even accounting for the graphic design layout and stuff in that 6 weeks. So it's even longer than that, because, you know, we can't just like magically, but if we could magically input the cards right away and have it all fixed, that's kind of where we sit. So I think that, you know, it's just important as it can feel like we can be very reactive and rapid, but there's also just the reality of like, sometimes if things miss a window, it does mean that it's going to be another 6 months. But this is also why that bookend of April to November makes a lot of sense, because it kind of is a 6-month window where we can like move things forward. in a way that works within those processes and that timeline and all of that stuff. But it's wild, right? If there was a faster way to do it, I guarantee you we would. But at the end of the day, we really prioritize being as close to correct as possible and making sure that we've thoroughly crossed our T's and dotted our J's before we pull triggers on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. That's all good.
It's good.
Got time for two more questions. Andy, you got one, and then I've got one at the end, and then we shall wrap. So, Andy, what you got?
What is your current favorite units? Nice and easy.
Yeah, simple. Ends it. Ends it.
Hardest question you've ever asked, I think, on this.
Well, no, the last one's pretty of a big stumper.
Because my current favorites are all ones that are unannounced, I think, which is the problem.
I mean, you could mention them. That's fine.
You could mention them. I would never be allowed on another podcast again, I think.
You'd be like, go full Tom Holland and just do
that. It's true. Just be like, whatever. Everybody dies at the end. It's fine.
What? Yes.
Sure, accidental won't hurt.
Go ahead.
Do you have one, Dursum? Go.
I do, but go ahead. Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry.
No, I don't have one yet. I'm still thinking.
I also don't want to spoil things because I like my job. But in terms of things that I am allowed to talk about, I think that they've been my favorite unit ever since we started, you know, internally testing the new edition. I just love the snowtroopers. Particularly the big squads of them. You know, I'll take them with the flamethrower and throw some impact grenades on there. So you've got this whole very durable package. You know, you just steady shoot your E-11s as you move up. You can flamethrower things when you get close. The impact grenades give you a nice little anti-vehicle package there. I've definitely surprised some people when I, you know, play some games at the local game store where it's like, all right, well, you got two ATSDs. I'm just going to run 30 snowtroopers at you, and some of them will get there, and they're going to blow your two ATSDs up.
Eventually,
so good luck killing all of those red defense dice snowtroopers. And I'll run like the small unit with the ion sometimes as well. And I know that might not be like the most optimal configuration in the world, but it is a lot of fun to play.
That was the question. What is your favorite? Not the most optimal. Will?
I'm gonna semi cheat because they're not available yet, but we have shown the cards, so I feel like it's safe. I've been a real huge fan with Luke and Han on Tauntauns. Really love
where the Tauntauns
came out. For as much as I was excited about Luke on the Tauntaun with the lightsaber and everything, as I've discussed multiple times, the Hauntaun and where he like came out, the aggressiveness of his play, he really speaks to the bloodthirsty, like close combat army guy I used to be back in other games, where mostly I just wanted to scream at the top of my lungs and charge forward, right? Okay, and then just roll lots of dice. Player. Yeah. Oh yeah. Or Blood Angels, you know, like take your pick. I started with the Boys in Blue, like most people did way back in second edition. And I quickly learned that I could play the way I wanted to with a lot of Assault Marines, but it wasn't the way they were supposed to play. So I had to shift. I think it's because I have to be so thought conscious in most of my day to day that when I finally get to my games, I kind of just want to be able to just be like, screw it, just go, and like go in without a plan and be able to survive it and roll some dice and cause chaos and mayhem. And Hauntaun does that. Like, he does it really well, and it's very fun. And to me, it just really fits the image that I have of Han, like the Han that shot first and the guy who just like doesn't really worry about things the way he should, you know. He just shrugs.
Yep.
And he's like, I put all my points into charisma, it's fine, right?
Yeah.
Charisma and luck, thank you very much.
Yeah, charisma and luck, you know. Yeah. And so he started in a place that was fine, where Dursum and the team took him over the course of testing and really trying to define a unique role for him that also felt very Han Solo. I just love where he ended up, and I have so much fun with him, and being able to have Luke on the Tauntaun and get to see him do things outside of getting, you know, blindsided by a Wampa is very exciting to me because I think that imagery is so iconic and awesome of the knight on his mount that we really didn't get to see in the movies, that now I get to have my player what if and to see that, you know, play out in battle and all of that stuff.
That makes sense. Just a quick one. I mean, on that note, if like things going forward and getting involved, Fleet Troopers must be your thing, yeah?
You're gonna get Ben loves them.
That's like one of Ben's favorite units.
You're gonna get me in trouble because we're gonna go back to the whole like I think Fleet Troopers are one of the worst things personally. not by game rules, but by look. I can't. I'm sorry. They are perfectly designed to be the guys that just get mowed down by the cool looking troopers at the start of episode 4. Like you see those guys and they're lining up. You're like, they don't have a chance. You haven't even seen what the Empire is. What you have seen so far is that this tiny ship is getting chased by a massive ship. And then these like middle-aged men in Tour de France bike helmets show up and they're like, we got this. And then they start and they get shifty eyed and I swear like beads of sweat. And you're just like, nope, these guys are all dead. None of them are the hero of our story. So I can't get over the helmet.
In that same breath though, are you saying the same about the guys who fire the Death Star laser? Because they're in particularly similar hats.
So their helmet, yeah, yeah. So their helmet I enjoy because it's like bug light, because it's like all enclosed and they've got the cool like reflective visor. So they feel more cold and efficient, you know. And they're in black, which is more tactical, to be honest. Like who chooses blue and white for their combat gear? Like, come on. No.
They're not people in Underworld, apparently. People in Underworld.
But I will say that I have similar-ish feelings on the Bell helmets, like Veers's helmet.
Oh, okay.
Having gone through how big that helmet is, you don't understand. So you see it on screen and you're like, it's a big helmet, but it's not. But we have to really get into the weeds and like how actually big that helmet is compared to his head. And once you understand, like that's Dark Helmet sized helmet, like the joke for Dark Helmet and how big his helmet is. It kind of is canonically accurate to how large that bell is on those guys' head. And so it's just like, it's one of those things where I'm like, it looks cool in imagery, but to see it in real life on somebody's head, you're like, that's kind of silly, you know?
I was wondering how long it'd take for a Spaceballs reference to pop up. It's all good. Well, I suppose the last question then, and thank you for your time, though. The last question, as is tradition on here, and we've asked it about now. This might be the fourth time now. Gungans? ? You sort of did something earlier, which made me go, "Ooh, Gungans?" So that's the old question.
I did. I softballed this one, and it's my fault. So, but at the same time, it also means that we get to reset the clock. So, Dursum, let's go ahead and reset it.
Yeah, I mean, Gungans win, I guess.
Yeah. Gungans how? Right? Gungans who?
Gungans
how? Disco Gungans? I don't know.
You can't use Gungans why, because that opens up discussion. So you got to be like, Gungans how? Yeah.
Gungans could. Gungans should. Well, in which case, we'll just save that for the next time you guys have on.
There you go.
Well, minimum, it'll be Adepticon. Maybe a bit sooner. Yes. Who knows? And then yeah, I'll be putting the question. You'll see the piercing in my eyes. I'll be looking at you. Gungans?
Here's my hope for Adepticon. Slight spoilers ahead. My hope is that by the time that roadmap closes, you won't be asking that question.
Ooh.
And just like that, a tremor in the Force has just been sent out. So that went interesting. Well, thank you for coming on, guys. Time differences aside and all this sort of stuff, it's great to have you on as always and to catch up and all this sort of stuff. The mini extravaganza, obviously, you did a couple of weeks ago. It feels like only yesterday. From my perspective, I think that went absolutely brilliantly. I was watching it. I was just like, oh, and all these little the stuff at the end and all this sorts of stuff. And yeah, excited. I think it went down very well. And the feedback I've got from other people is just like, this is really cool. Loads of all this, loads of stuff. So I'll from them to you, thank you very much. And like to say, thank you very much for coming on the show. Is there anyone else you'd like to say cheers, shouts out to, or anything like that before we wrap up the show or say byes?
Just thanks to you know, the rest of our development team and everyone at AMG, and just, you know, shout out our playtesters who you know, help us make all these decisions and work on these projects. So, and yeah, all of you sure. Playing the game.
No, I think Dursum absolutely nailed it. We're lucky enough to get to come on and talk about these things and to feel firsthand the excitement of what the amazing team at AMG does. But like, the reality is that we're just two people on a team that pours their heart and souls into this stuff, loves Star Wars, loves games, love what we do. And it wouldn't happen without them. And also, we wouldn't get to come on and talk to this stuff without you guys. And, you know, hanging out in your evenings over across the pond and, you know, asking questions and being pillars of the community and all that stuff. So thank you so much. You know, we've all, I think yeah. Many of us across the studio have done podcasting, have done streaming at various points in our lives and careers. And I know it seems easy. It is anything but easy. It's harder than having a consistent RPG group, if you understand how difficult that is. Yep. And, and so just thank you so much for the passion and the energy you pour into it all the time. It's very, very humbling to have people who love the work that we do and the games that we get to partake in together in that way and want to do those kinds of things.
Nice. Thank you very much. And my promise to you guys is that I'll have individual intros for you at some point rather than just all of you giving the same Atomic by Blondie. So that's my promise, because that's how my little brain works with individual music. And then you can make them your ringtones. I mean, that's what Jeff
Oh, wants. I like it.
He's got great, he's got GJ Jazzy Jeff running on his phone, all that sort of stuff. But there we go. that has been a special of this That's No Moon, a Star Wars Legion podcast. I've been Cockles with Andy.
Goodbye.
Ollie. That was we couldn't hear you. You were muted somehow, but there we go.
I'm not muted, am I?
Well, we're quiet. Well, now we can hear you, but yes, and I've been Cockles, that's been Andy, you've been Ollie.
Batty bye.
Andrew Dursum from AMG.
Thanks, guys.
And Will Schick of AMG.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you for everyone listening. Goodbye.
You've been listening to That's No Moon, a Star Wars Legion podcast. To keep up to date with us, please like and follow us on Facebook. That's No Moon, a Star Wars Legion podcast, and Instagram, That's No Moon Podcast.